dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the War of Ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. A man whose intelligence is generously shared with us each week and is of surpassing importance is that of David Goldman. He is known by some of his fans as Spengler, the byline that he uses in the Asia Times. I think of it as his nom de guerre. He is also the author of How Civilizations Die and a world-class financier, a man we respect greatly and are delighted to welcome him actually in person to the Center for Security Policy. I happen not to be there myself, but he is. David, it's good to have you in every sense of the word.
Frank, it is an honor and privilege to spend time with you. Thank you.
Thank you. So, David, I came across a piece that I guess was a print of a speech that you gave, quite a formidable address, really, on China's strategy at the Heritage Foundation. It came over by transom the other day. If you could just very quickly give us kind of the distilled essence of what China's strategy is at the moment.
Frank, think of Facebook and Google. You give them their data. They give you what appear to be free services, but they use it to extract masses of advertising revenue and basically wipe everybody out of the business. Now, if you take that model and apply it to industrial production, consumer spending, healthcare, environmental studies, urban traffic management, driverless cars, every single aspect of the world economy run by a massive centralized computer system with every smartphone in the world acting as a data gathering instrument for the Chinese, that's their plan. It's to dominate the world economy through communications, technology, artificial intelligence, which will force everybody to shop at the Chinese company store and give them vast power. And when we worry about the amount of data that Google and Facebook have, which all of us do from a privacy standpoint and a matter of political power, multiply that by thousands, and you have an idea of what China has in mind.
Well, that's ominous, needless to say. In practice, what does it mean if it's weaponized against us? Something that arguably Google and Facebook are doing for their political purposes, but in the hands of a hostile power.
Well, it would allow them to strangle our technologies, shut down our ability to communicate, control critical supplies of everything from rare earths to antibiotics. You name it, it'd give them an absolute stranglehold over the world economy, a kind of power which no one has had, not Rome, not Genghis Khan, not the British at their peak. It's absolutely staggering. It's like the Borg. You will be assimilated.
It is the Borg, indeed. And its engine, I guess, the mechanical piece of it at least, is this company Huawei, about which you are writing a book. Is that right?
Absolutely. As a senior official of Huawei was telling me recently, you can go into a clinic in China, put a little device on your finger, and it gets your oxygen level, blood pressure, and heartbeat, and a bunch of other things. Now imagine you send all of that information from a billion people every day up into the cloud. You crunch all that data along with everyone's health records. At that point, you have a depth of knowledge and control over medical technology, which nobody could imagine, because artificial intelligence, Frank, is simply a matter of access to data. The trick is they're playing Tom Sawyer. Give us your data, just like Google and Facebook say, but it's not simply about your advertising and consumer preferences. It's about every container that moves across the ocean, every gadget that moves across the factory floor, every health procedure in the world. It's utterly comprehensive.
It's what it is. Artificial intelligence is part of it, of course. Quantum computing, you know, data mining, surveillance technologies, all of these things folded into the Borg is just a national security peril, of course, as well as something that will, I'm afraid, be indeed used against us in that manner. David, let me just turn quickly, because I wanted to ask you about one other application of what the Chinese are up to. We're watching President Trump in the person of his Vice President Mike Pence and Mike Pompeo, the Secretary of State, in Turkey at the moment, threatening, basically, I gather, sanctions against Turkey to get it to adopt a ceasefire in this invasion that it's mounted in Syria. And yet, the sanctions don't seem to be having any perceptible effect. Could that have something to do with China?
It has everything to do with China, Frank. Last March, when we put sanctions on Turkey, the Turkish lira collapsed by 10% in a matter of minutes, just went through the floor. They're massively indebted. It's a weak currency, very weak economy. This time, hardly a flutter on the money markets in Turkey. Currency is basically unchanged. Interest rates are unchanged. The difference is China has publicly and visibly put billions of dollars into Turkey in the last several weeks, and there's probably a good deal more behind that. Effectively, China is using the spat between the U.S. and Turkey to buy up Turkey on the cheap and make it a satrapy of the Chinese economic co-prosperity sphere, or whatever you want to call it.
And this is fits nicely into the various purposes to which this Belt and Road Initiative of Xi Jinping is being applied, fracturing the alliance, gaining strategic assets and positioning, and not least, you know, undermining American foreign policy, such as it is.
Oh, they have definitely put a hole in our side. If you look at the whole Eurasian continent with Turkey as the terminus of the new Silk Road on the Mediterranean Sea and China's launching pad to Europe, with Turkey in tow, controlling Turkey's logistics, China runs the shipping from the Mediterranean Sea to the South China Sea and everything in between. The amount of control and economic power they have by integrating Turkey as the terminus of their Belt and Road Initiative is enormous, and they're buying it at a very cheap price.
But is it in fact a terminus, or is it simply one part of the infrastructure that is now in Greece? The Germans are now saying they're going to allow Huawei into their telecommunications network. There are other nations in Europe that have done the same.
I'm told off the record by Huawei that every single major telecom provider in Europe is signing on. There's resistance from exactly nobody on the European continent.
Wow. And do you credit that?
Yes, I've certainly. If Angela Merkel personally intervened, as the papers are saying, to make sure that Germany played ball with Huawei in order not to damage Germany's relations with China, no one else is going to resist. If the Germans go along, everyone will follow suit. We know the French are. So that's the two largest economies in Europe. And in fact, there are already Huawei 5G base stations being set up in England.
Yeah. The Borg is upon us. Let us be aware of it. David, thank you for your time today and for the clarity that you bring to the stakes that are associated with what the Chinese strategic plan is and what it will mean for all of us. Come back to us next week if you would. In the meantime, God bless you. I know you'll keep up the good work at Asia Times and elsewhere. Next up, we'll speak with Dr. Zudi Jasser right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
We're back. It's a distinct privilege to say, joined by Dr. Zudi Jasser. Dr. Jasser is a friend and colleague and man I've admired greatly for quite some time, notably for the work he does on behalf of our country as the president and founder of the American Islamic Forum for Democracy. He's a medical doctor by training, but a freedom fighter, as I see it, the author, among many, many things, of A Battle for the Soul of Islam, An American Muslim Patriot's Fight to Save His Faith. Among other things, Dr. Jasser has served in the uniform of the United States Navy, rising to the rank of Lieutenant Commander, and a great ally in these challenging times, who also was recognized for his leadership with an appointment to the U.S. Commission on International Religious Freedom by Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell. At the time, he was the minority leader, now the majority leader, of course, of the Senate. Zudi Jasser, so much to say about you, but there's so much to say about so many other things. Welcome. It's so good to have you back. Welcome.
Thank you, Frank. It's always great to be with you. Thanks for all that you do.
It's a team effort here. In that connection, Zudi, I want to spend some of our time talking with you about what's happening here on the home front and the fight that you've been engaged in, I think, very courageously and for the soul of Islam, as you call it. But before we do that, you are, of course, your family, at least, is, of course, originally from Syria. And I know that this has been an extraordinarily painful couple of years for you as you've watched what's been happening to that country. And I imagine it's particularly difficult at the moment. Your quick thoughts on what's happening and, in particular, what U.S. policy should be with respect to Syria at the moment.
Well, thanks, Frank. And I have to tell you, we always have to predicate this discussion today in 2019 with understanding that we got here in this mess in Syria because the previous administration handed, with its Iran affiliate, billions of ransom and just handed over Middle Eastern policy to Iran, empowered Hezbollah, empowered the terrorist state of Iran, and stood and sat idly by while half a million died and 10 million got displaced and empowered Erdogan and others. So now we're sort of left with this. I get the policy of withdrawing troops. I actually support that. I find that we're really not doing that much there, and it's not our problem, if you will. But the question is, how do you do it? And I think the impulsivity with which it was done in the past week and the benefits that it gives Erdogan to think that somehow that serves American security, I don't get it. I think we could have telegraphed it a little bit better and saying that, you know what, why are American troops at this border? Erdogan already threatened you all with sending 3 million refugees into Europe. This is a NATO problem for Europe, not for the United States. And why don't you have NATO troops doing what American troops were doing? But instead, we pulled out so quickly, we actually had to implode our own materiel that was there because we were worried about the Turks getting it. They should have, we really should have addressed their presence in NATO years ago because they're a radical jihadist state based on the AKP party platform, if you will, with the Brotherhood. So I'm not sure I understand what happened this week with our policy, but I hope we can put it back together. The Kurds have long been an ally. I get the fact that the PKK are communists, may be considered terrorists by some, but the Kurds are 40 million strong. The YPG, Peshmerga, have been our strongest ally, save Israel in the Middle East. And there's not been one American that I know of ever hurt by the Kurds. And they've been areas of peace where we've served with them. So to abandon them hurts our strength, hurts what we stand for. And it really breaks my heart to see this happen. And last, I have to tell you, the reason this is happening, and as a Syrian, many of us have, and as have the Kurds, supported a federal Syria. They've not wanted their own state. But I have to tell you, for the first time, many of us, I'm Sunni, as the Kurds are, but I'm not Kurdish, I'm Arabic. And we're now basically supporting a Kurdish state, because I think if they had their own state, they would have not been given in a platter to Erdogan over the last few days.
Yeah. Well, there's a lot to unpack there. I'm going to resist the temptation to do so, Zudi, simply because I want to get to a couple of other things that are also important. And you've sort of teed it up perfectly by describing Erdogan. I think of him as a Sharia supremacist, and I know that you have been confronting him and his ilk for quite some time now. Could you talk a little bit about how you see at the moment Turkey not only being very hostile to our interests in the Middle East, but also what Turkey has been doing to sort of pick up the mantle, if you will, of one of, if not the chief state sponsor of the Muslim Brotherhood and the other Sharia supremacist organizations that you confront and challenge basically daily in what you call the struggle for the soul of Islam in this country?
Really understanding what Erdogan is and what the AKP or the Muslim Brotherhood of Turkey is so important to understanding global political Islam, because Basically, Erdogan, when he was mayor of Istanbul, said that democracy is like a train. You use it until you get to where you want to go, and then you get off. So to the Islamists, the populist Islamists, if you will, the Sharia supremacists, which are like the corporate Islamists, like the royal families and the militaries of Egypt and others. But then you've got the populist Islamists that are much more dangerous, like the Islamists of Turkey and the Khomeinists. And they've been working closely with Qatar, who's basically aligned themselves with the global movement of political Islam. And in the last 2 years, really thanks to President Trump, we've seen the separation away of Saudi Arabia and Egypt away from the Muslim Brotherhood fealty, if you will. And Turkey now is beginning to sort of lead that global movement to reestablish in a neo-Ottoman kind of way the Islamist movement globally. And Erdogan sees himself as sort of the leader of that caliphate. And you'll see Islamists in the West like Ilhan Omar, Rashida Tlaib, meeting with Erdogan, conspiring with him, and basically working against American interests to advance Islamists around the world and help fund their movements.
Yeah, this is really alarming. And it's just one of the reasons why, Zudi, we feel at the Center for Security Policy that, you know, Turkey really can't be regarded as an ally anymore, even though nominally it still is as a member of NATO. But I think what you're talking about is grounds for seeing it in a very different light, and will be very interesting to see what happens with Mike Pence and Mike Pompeo, Vice President, Secretary of State, and their delegation in Turkey today. We'll be talking more about that, of course, tomorrow. But in your dealings with the Muslim Brotherhood, you have made it very clear that they do not speak for American Muslims. You have put together a Muslim reform movement. You have, of course, your own American Islamic Forum for Democracy. How is it that the Brotherhood has been treated by, I think not so much this administration, but certainly the previous one and the one before that, for that matter, as the leaders of the American Muslim community? And what are the implications of doing so?
Well, the reason they've been given far more bandwidth than they deserve. I mean, the bandwidth they deserve is truly most polls, and we saw in the Arab Awakening, they represent about 20-30% of the Muslim world, even when elections are held. Now, that's a huge number. We're talking about 500 million people if you do the math of 1.5 billion. But still, it's not a majority. And especially in the West, I think those numbers are smaller since in the West, most of our families came here escaping the tyranny of Islamists and Sharia supremacists of many varieties. But the bottom line is the red-green axis, that axis between the socialists who like to collectivize identity politic groups, and they use Muslim minorities to sort of check that box. And you see that bond between AOC and Ilhan Omar and Rashida Tlaib as sort of representing exactly what happens in the UN between the anti-Israel, anti-Semitic countries of the Islamists and the socialists on the left. And that marriage is exactly what I see played out every day in the front lines here in Arizona, in New York, and media, and sort of on the coast. And meanwhile, the Muslim community here, we're trying to wake them up, but often they're pretty quiet because the Islamists are ruthless. They will target our families. They will target and use any means necessary not to deal with the message, because when we debate them, as we just saw I did in Australia, they're revealed as being disloyal and being actually anti-American.
Yeah. A really important debate that you had, 3-1, let it be said, but you nonetheless comported yourself handsomely, as you always do, Zudi Jasser. And I just want to say that we first met, I believe, in connection with a contribution, very important contribution, I think your first cinematic appearance, as a matter of fact, in a film we made together called Islam versus Islamists. And you really helped clarify why it is we don't hear more from quiet American Muslims who, like you, love this country, don't want to live under Sharia, don't want to impose it on the rest of us, and yet are frightened into silence, or worse, even perhaps going along with these Sharia supremacists, political Islamists, whichever you want to call them, and their really subversive agenda in our country. And I just wanted to say a word of specific thanks to you, Dr. Zudi Jasser, because you have recently addressed this very problem in the community of Norwich, Connecticut, after the Muslim Brotherhood, or front organization known as the Council on American Islamic Relations, Connecticut chapter, went after the chairman of the board of the Center for Security Policy, Miles Prentice, an extraordinary patriot and businessman, simply because he is the chairman of our board and because they have vilified us as haters and bigots and so on. And I just want to thank you for what you have done to help the mayor of Norwich and the community of Norwich to understand that when CARE denounces people, that's not by any means, you know, actually an indictment of them. Perhaps it's a badge of honor. And I wish that you were given equal time to the Council on American Islamic Relations in that setting, as well as so many others, because your voice needs to be heard, and to the extent that you really are a much more faithful representative of American Muslims, it is a real disservice to them that the Brotherhood and its ilk are given such prominence. Zuhdi, we're hard out of time. Thanks for joining us today. Come back to us again very soon, if you would. Dr. Zuhdi Jasser, please check out his important work at AIFdemocracy.org, the American Islamic Forum for Democracy. Come back to us again soon, Zuhdi.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
We're back, joined by one of my favorite people, Elaine Donnelly, a courageous woman who has for years given voice to the voiceless, our military personnel, men and women in uniform, who fight our nation's wars, but generally speaking, are unable to fight in the public arena when their interests are on the line. And for that, I want to say a personal and heartfelt thank you to Elaine and her marvelous organization, the Center for Military Readiness, for standing the lonely watch and for tirelessly championing the common sense policies that have been so badly opposed and violated, really, by, to some degree, successive administrations now, notably, most especially that of Barack Obama, but the one before, and to some extent, even the one today. Elaine, welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio. It's so good to have you with us, and again, to have a chance to thank you for what you do.
And thank you for all the kind words. Yes, we've been watching the experiments going on in our military for, well, 26 years now, and many of the predictions made two or more decades ago, it's all sorting out now. We're finding out there's a lot of failure. Even though people predicted if women were put into the combat arms, rates of sexual assault would go down, the indicators are to the opposite. We spent some time plowing through years of Pentagon reports to track the trends, and the trends are not good. We know that in the past year, a 15% hike in 1 year in sexual assaults, 146% increase since fiscal year 2007. This is not good. And then on the physical side of women in combat, we see tests have been done, preliminary testing for the Army Combat Fitness Test. This is a new test. It's not even fully in effect yet. The failure rate for women soldiers is 84%. There's a reason for this, because there are physical differences between men and women that matter, as with sexual assault. There are sexual differences between men and women that matter. Human characteristics are starting to become more and more obvious, and the policymakers have got to start facing up to this. This social experiment is not working out. Just today, in the Washington Examiner, training injuries are the biggest medical threat to military readiness. And at the end of the article, it says, well, this new Army Combat Fitness Test, it's going to increase injuries. Well, yes, it will, and yet we're doing it anyway. The Army is doing it anyway, and the women are getting the worst of it. If they really wanted to force women out of the military, this is a good way to do it.
Yeah. I did want to correct something you said, and I do this with trepidation, but I know I'm right. You said when you began your remarks just now that you have been watching this for years. You've been doing so much more than watching or even collecting data and conducting important research. You have been a champion. You have been active and engaged and pulling others in behind you, specifically to to help us all understand, and too few of us do, the unique and vital nature of the social, well, culture, if you will, of the United States military, and the real consequences, not only for those most immediately involved, and you're talking about women being hurt or otherwise harmed, you know, sexual assault and the like, because of this kind of crazy social experimentation or engineering of the military with complete disregard for that culture. And I just wanted to say we've had a new book. I had a chance to interview its author a few weeks back, James Hassan. It's entitled Stand Down, How Social Justice Warriors are Sabotaging America's Military. And I think he makes a very powerful case that that's exactly what we've been doing. You have been making that case for years. He does some nice homage to you in that book and the Center for Military Readiness. But Elaine, talk to us about what the implications are for our military, the readiness, the combat, you know, capabilities of our military, and what that obviously portends for our security as a nation and as a people of all of this engineering.
The book Stand Down, How Social Justice Warriors Are Sabotaging America's Military. I was so happy to see it in progress. I did not know the author, James Hassan, when he began the book. He has sources that I would never have been able to reach. People in ranger training, for instance.
Yeah, he's a former ranger qualified Army officer, as I recall.
Yes, he's been through the ranger course, and he served in Afghanistan, and they trusted him to tell the truth. And I've been in this, I've been a recipient of confidential information in the past, too. But what he found out about the ranger training shows that the Army's pursuit of women in combat, putting women in the infantry, it was all based on this test at the ranger school that was skewed to make sure that two women graduated. And we remember their smiling faces. They were so proud. He's not critical of those women, and I'm not either. The problem is the policymakers who pretended and who believe in, Amazon myths that men and women are interchangeable in the combat arms. But if the test to prove that was skewed from the start, and when we know that the Marines research, 3 years of research, showed and predicted the kinds of failure rates and injury rates that we're seeing now, it's like a perfect storm that is forming. And this administration in the next term, perhaps, is going to have to face up to this. But it's going to be difficult because the new chairman of the Joint Chiefs, General Mark Milley, was the former chief of staff of the Army, and he presided over all of these things. And we also know the Secretary of Defense, former Secretary of the Army. It's going to take leadership from the president himself, and the military is resilient. If it gets new orders, it will follow those orders. So what we do here at the Center for Military Readiness is we have been documenting, and yes, we research, we analyze, we put out reports so that people, policymakers say, wait a minute, maybe we're on the wrong track. And that's worth doing because people in uniform, men and women, they can't speak for themselves. They can't come out publicly and say things as they did to this author, James Hassan, in deep confidence. The book rings true.
Yeah. And this is really the key point. The returns are coming in. We're seeing the hard evidence that backs up what you and now James have been warning of. And it's vital that we get this right, because at the end of the day, the military can't do what we need it to do if it's broken. And that means not just in the sense of, you know, the tanks aren't ready or the ships aren't ready. It's the people aren't ready. And that's not fair to them. And it's certainly risky for us. Elaine, I did want to, you mentioned Donald Trump and, you know, his leadership and the kind of direction that's going to be required going forward with respect to this larger sort of abiding social experimentation with the military. One of the places where he did engage, and very directly, and then got into all kinds of hassles with courts and activists and so on, but was on this transgender business. Can you give us an update on where things stand with respect to that, and how that may be a model for what we need to be seeing him do with respect to, well, for example, women in ground combat?
Right. Well, earlier this year, the Supreme Court, after a court of appeals ruled the same way, said that the Trump administration could proceed with implementation of the Trump-Mattis policy regarding transgenders. It's a nuanced policy. It does allow people who came out under Obama, they can still stay in the military. And it probably will be upheld eventually by the Supreme Court, but that the litigation is still going forward. Now, this was definitely a very good thing for the president to have done. Department of Justice has done a good job defending the policy in court. But on the issues of women in the military, you're right. We need to see something comparable, and the sooner the better. And the best way to do this, as we have recommended for many years, is look at the policies, look at the results. Don't, you know, talk about Amazon warrior myths and what social justice warriors predict. They've been proven wrong so many times, it's pathetic. They need to look at the facts. They need to make a considered decision and say, wait a minute, we can't have a physical fitness test where 84% of the women are failing. That makes no sense. The problem is they're trying to force all women, even those in support roles, into training that pretends that they're all going to go in the infantry or in physically demanding jobs that used to be all male. This is a mistake. The Presidential Commission on which I served said you can have different standards for men and women, provided that the women are not aimed for the combat arms. Now that they are eligible for the combat arms, thanks to the previous administration, these gender norming or different standards for men and women make common sense, but they are no longer tenable. So something's got to give between that and the sexual assault numbers that keep going up and up and up and up. The military cannot go on like this. So one of the points made in James's book is, when are we going to fix this? The time is now. It's now or never. And that's one of the issues that should matter in the next presidential race. We certainly hope so, but the conservative movement is going to have to show more awareness.
Well, and courage, too. Again, I want to single you out for a special commendation in that regard, but you have demonstrated your courage. And I'm sorry to say that an awful lot of other people who should be on side are nowhere to be seen. And again, this is all the more important, it seems to me, Elaine, and this just have to be probably our last comment, but what's fundamentally going on here has been a desire on the part of these social engineers, social justice warriors, if you will, to re-engineer American society, not just the military. It's just that they found that they could do it to the military because of the kind of discipline that it operates under, civilian control, most especially. But it's bad for the military, and it's not going to be good for the society writ large, I would argue, either. Elaine Donnelly, thanks for the service you render to our country. Keep it up. I know you will. Come back to us again soon.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back and joined by another hero of mine, a man who has led the Center for Immigration Studies, another extraordinarily consequential organization doing research in the whole arena of immigration policy at the borders and interior of the United States, and giving concrete and always very thoughtful, constructive suggestions about what we should be doing instead of what altogether too often we are doing, which is not effective enforcement of the laws of the United States. And it's a delight to say welcome back to Mark Krikorian, the executive director of the Center for Immigration Studies. Good to have you, sir. Welcome.
Glad to be here. Thanks for having me.
Well, Mark, I hardly know where to begin. I gather there is some good news, finally. The president is at pains to point out that the border wall is being built. He's also been citing some very important collaboration with the Mexican government as helping to attenuate at least somewhat the immigration surge that we've been seeing in recent years. Give us an update on that, and what's making the difference as you see it?
The problem of border jumping was really getting out of control. It reached a peak in May. It was a ludicrous level, something we hadn't seen in years and years. And it's gone down since then. It's still higher than it needs to be. It still needs to keep going down more, but it has dropped a good amount. Part of the reason for that is that Mexico has been way more cooperative than I would have expected, especially with this. They have a populist left-wing president who was elected last year, but he's actually been probably the most cooperative Mexican ruler, Mexican administration on immigration. And I think the reason is not just what people think. Remember, the president made threats about tariffs against Mexico and what have you. And I think that probably did contribute to their, you know, it did focus their mind on the issue. But I actually think more important than that is that this flow is different. This isn't Mexican illegals, because Mexico is going to stand up for their own people in some sense, or they're certainly not going to help us against them. These are overwhelmingly now foreigners, people from Central America, but now even from the Caribbean, from Africa, from the Middle East. And Mexicans are proud, patriotic people. They love their country, as they should, and they are tired of their country being used as a doormat. And there's always been a certain amount of this, but, you know, people kept going. They were out by sundown, you know, it's that kind of thing. So they didn't really worry about it. It has gotten to such a level, and it is so in their face, in the Mexican public's face, that the Mexicans are really reacting against this. And this may not last, but we have a confluence of interests with Mexico, believe it or not, on immigration, where both of us want to stop this flow of third country nationals to the U.S. border. So this is, you know, it's not like everything's over. It's not like everything's fixed. But, you know, you don't see good news very often in this business. And I think here we have an example of how we in Mexico are successfully working together to try to stamp down this flow of bogus asylum seekers.
Now, I think this is a hugely important point. And as with you, Mark, I couldn't be more surprised that AMLO, as he's been called, has been actually helpful. I gather, especially in allowing us to hold people in Mexico that are being processed for asylum claims as well. Is that factored into this, do you think?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's the other part of it. I was talking specifically about, you know, their efforts on their own southern border. But what you're talking about is, you know, maybe equally important. And they're calling that, the sort of shorthand name for this policy is the Remain in Mexico program. And what that involves is that people who sneak across the border or who come up to a crossing point and ask for asylum still get to apply for asylum, which is kind of outrageous since they've gone through all these countries, but our law does require it. So they get to apply for asylum. The wrinkle here is that they don't just get let go into the United States with a piece of paper and a hearing date, and, you know, we may never hear of them again. They have to go and wait back in Mexico for their hearing date. And only when their, you know, time comes up, their number comes up, can they then go and say, here's my paper, please let me in, I'm going to the hearing. That takes away a huge amount of the appeal of filing these FACO asylum claims, because the whole point of those claims was to be released and disappear into the U.S. If you can't do that, it makes it a lot less interesting and appealing to do. And Mexico had to agree to that because they don't have to take back people from third countries once they get into the United States. They're not their own citizens, you know. So, again, that's another example where Mexico has been more cooperative with us than I ever would have expected.
Yeah. Let me just ask you, Mark, because this has been nagging me for some time, and I've been meaning to try to track down an expert like you in this. Is it not under international law that you're required to seek amnesty or asylum, rather, seek asylum in the first country that you can present yourself to? So, I mean, effectively, this has not been some sort of outrageous position of the Trump administration to say, wait a minute, you can't pick the one you want to be getting that status in, namely ours.
Yeah, the answer is yes and no. The Refugee Convention, it's a treaty signed in 1951, and then we signed on to the sort of the next, the part in 1968. And what it requires what it says, it's Article 31 for anybody who wants to look it up in the UN Convention on Refugees. What it says is that if a person, the person can't be turned down for asylum just because they're illegal, so long as they came directly from the country where they were being persecuted. So that gets to your point. You can't go and asylum shop, or you, or let me put it this way. The countries that signed that treaty are have not bound themselves to accepting people who have asylum shopped. The problem is our asylum law, which incorporated that treaty into law, does allow asylum shopping. So it's a legal problem that we have imposed on ourselves. If we change the 1980 Refugee Act, that would be a different story. But even there, there's another wrinkle. Because the practical question then for someone, say, who has snuck into the U.S., they've gone through, maybe they flew to Ecuador from Africa, and then they took a bus and walked all the way. So they went through, 12 countries maybe at least? But if they get into the U.S., where do we return them to? I mean, I guess we could fly them back home, but if they have a legitimate asylum claim, then we're kind of stuck with them. And Mexico is, not eager to take them back. Like I said, they've been more cooperative, but there's a limit to that. So anyway, what you're saying is yes, but we have handcuffed ourselves to a certain degree by allowing more asylum shopping than we ever should have.
But we have, I think, as you've indicated, Mark Krikorian, been benefiting from the fact that these claims are being processed in Mexico or people are being held in Mexico pending their processing rather than getting into the country and being basically turned loose.
And I think that's clearly part of what's making it less appealing and what's causing the numbers to start going down. But of course, a lot of people are already going anyway. So it's not like it's you switch the light off and it stops. You have to keep it up so that people get different expectations and realize this isn't worth doing.
Well, and that brings me to my last question for you, Mark. And that is, there is talk that we may have changes to our immigration policies, that is to say, statutory changes, that Jared Kushner, the president's son-in-law, has been working to put together in a sort of comprehensive legislative package. The timing on this is a little unclear, but I just wanted to ask you a basic question. Is it advisable under present circumstances, the Congress being divided and the House, of course, being in Democratic hands, to be pushing this kind of agenda forward at this moment in time, with the best of intentions and perhaps language in the starting bill?
No, I don't think it is. The bill that we don't know all the details yet, but they have talked about some of the details. And there would be a lot of good things in there related to illegal immigration control. There would be some good changes to legal immigration in this proposal, but it would not cut overall immigration levels. So it's really, it's not necessarily, even in the abstract, an ideal piece of legislation. But as a practical matter, it is, like you said, a comprehensive so-called immigration bill. Well, it's not likely to pass, but why are we taking the chance? I mean, this is the kind of thing that if it starts to get moving in Congress, Democrats will start adding amnesties onto it. If you're going to propose legislation on immigration, whether it's now or any time, but I think especially in the current situation, they should be targeted, narrow measures, Keith.
Mark Krikorian, I hope you come back to us again very soon. I hope the rest of you will do the same again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.